All right, so this morning we're going to pick up a little bit of where we left off last week, even though we are going to kind of backtrack just about a half step, because I want to start giving us some context for what we talked about a little bit last week, and then also what we're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks as well. So, as per usual, let's catch up with where we've been so far. This week and next week, we'll do a fully detailed recounting of what's happened before. And then after that, we're going to kind of shorten things up to make sure that we can get through all of this material at the very end. But specifically for these next 2 weeks, we want to make sure that we are covering or making sure that we remember what we've covered so far so that we can understand the case that we're making and understand the points that we are talking about. So we've talked about why we are studying the resurrection. We've talked about the history of it. We've talked about the apologetic side of it. And now we're dealing with the theology of it. We're dealing with the theology of Jesus' resurrection and how that points towards our resurrection. When we talked about the history of the resurrection, we talked about how Jesus' resurrection was unique among the ancient world. Among all of the gods, quote unquote, who were supposed to have died and been raised, Jesus was the only one who actually died and was raised. Additionally, Jesus' story is completely different from the rest of those stories. And we also have eyewitness accounts. We also have evidence to prove that Jesus' resurrection actually happened. When we go through the Old Testament and we deal with the prophecies that were looking forward to the time of Christ, we noticed that there were prophecies that talked about the resurrection of a Messiah. There were prophecies that talked about the Christ and how he would die, how he would be buried, and how he would be raised. And so when we came to the New Testament, we determined that if Jesus was the Messiah, he was going to have to be raised. And that's what we dealt with when we got to the gospel accounts. When we got to the actual story of Jesus, we talked about how there are five consistent resurrection accounts. You put them all together and you get one story about Jesus's resurrection. And then we talked about the other evidence that exists out there. We talked about the other biblical evidence. We talked about the other witnesses. And we talked about the extra biblical evidence, the stuff outside the Bible that proves to us that Jesus rose from the dead. We have evidence upon evidence upon evidence that Jesus rose from the dead. And so, as we looked at that, we started to shift toward our theology, and we looked at, okay, if Jesus rose from the dead, what rose from the dead? And we looked at those stories about Jesus' resurrection. We looked at the things that happened after he was raised, and we noticed that he was raised in the same body that he died in. The same body that went into the tomb came out of the tomb, and the tomb is empty. It was a physical body, and yet it still had some kind of unique features to it. That same physical body now was able to do things that it didn't do before. We noticed a lot of things that Jesus did in this transformed state after his resurrection. And so that brought us into last week, building all of that up, that brought us into 1 Corinthians 15, which talks about the resurrection of Jesus. And says that if we believe in the resurrection of Jesus, then we have to believe that there will be a future, what we call a quote-unquote general resurrection. And so that's where we're going to pick up today. We're going to talk a little bit about the general resurrection. What does the Bible tell us, at least about the prophesying of it, at least the teachings of it? Next week, we're going to deal with more of the details of this kind of thing. We're going to deal with some of the very specific things that the Bible gets into about the general resurrection. But what we're going to look at today is the fact that the Bible talks about it. The Bible points toward it. The Bible prophesies it all throughout the scriptures. And so as we get into it, I promise that I did not plan it this way. When I initially started planning this class, I had a couple of different things here and there throughout that I've scratched out. A couple of different things, a couple of weeks that went longer than they were supposed to. And so I was not intending to talk about the resurrection on Halloween, but I do think that it's kind of funny that it didn't end up happening that way. I realized it yesterday that that was what was going to be happening today. So sorry about that. That's kind of weird. If it makes you uncomfortable, don't worry. The future resurrection is still a long way away. It won't happen tonight. Well, or will it? I don't know. When we start looking back at the Bible and we look at the early Jewish thought of afterlife, pick up your Bible and read from Genesis to Malachi. Don't do it right now, obviously. But if you read from Genesis to Malachi and we read about the Jewish ideas of what there was to come, if you were to read all of those books and try to compile together what it is that the Bible says or that the Jews said about the afterlife, you could be excused for thinking that there's not much there. You could even be excused for thinking that the Jews didn't have a concept of the afterlife. Because not only is there not much there, what is there is kind of difficult to find. It's a little bit difficult to dig into, kind of the same way as we were dealing with some of the prophecies about Jesus' resurrection. It's a little bit difficult to dig in and discover what the Jews thought about afterlife. As we deal with some of this, most of the time in the Old Testament, they're just not going to talk about what they believe is coming. Now, again, I say most of the time, it's very general, broad, sweeping brush. There are some points, we're going to talk about them. There are some points where that happens, but as a broad, sweeping brush, it's just not there. And it's not that they're scared of the afterlife. It's not that they're depressed by it. It's not anything like that. It's just that they're very focused on other things. And so as we think through that, maybe let's put ourselves in a mindset and understand why this might be the case. Maybe it's because God is progressively revealing to them some of the things that are going to happen. As God begins his relationship with the Israelites, the first five books of the Old Testament tell that story to us, but also are the first books that the Israelites are going to receive. These are the first things that talk to them about their relationship with God. And so at the very beginning of their relationship with God, they probably don't need to be super focused on what's coming at the end. They need to be focused on the here and now and how do we keep up with this relationship with God. It's only as you get closer and closer to the time of Jesus that we start seeing the idea of the afterlife developed in Jewish thought. But even as we get closer to the time of Jesus, what we're going to notice is that a lot of these authors still don't really have a good grasp on what there is to come. And so as we look at death in the Old Testament, what we're going to find is that it's not considered what we might consider today a happy release. You know, when we think about death today, a lot of times, especially with the death of a Christian, we're going to think about how they're gone to a better place, right? That's how we're going to describe it. That's not really the way the Jews are looking at it throughout most of the Old Testament. For the most part, they're going to see death as sad and even maybe connected with some kind of evil. But of course, as they evolve and they begin to understand more and God begins to reveal more to them, they start to change the way that they think. And so as we read through the Old Testament, we're going to see three stages of development in their views of the afterlife. We're going to start off and we're going to see the first idea in the early parts of the Old Testament and in the early writings of the Old Testament. We're going to see either they're just not going to talk about death in the afterlife, or they're not going to have very positive thoughts about it. Let's take a look for just a minute at Genesis chapter 3. This first book, of course, is relating to us what happened in the Garden of Eden. This first book written by Moses, obviously inspired by God, but telling the Israelites what happened at the beginning of all of history. And so after Adam and Eve have sinned in the Garden of Eden and God is bringing down his punishments upon everybody, in Genesis 3 and verse 19, he says, "By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, because from it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return." And that's it. There's nothing further after that. And so if we were just to pick up in Genesis chapter 3, we'd have a pretty bleak view of death, because that's just where it stops. You started at dust, you're going to end at dust. There doesn't seem to be much more beyond that, at least in Genesis chapter 3. When we pick up in Psalm 6, later on in the history of Israel, they've started to develop a little bit more of their ideas, and they've got the idea of Sheol. And of course, we're talking about the land of shadows. And so again, they've started to develop what they think happens at the end. But in Psalm 6 and verse 5, the psalmist says, "There is no mention of you," speaking to God, "there is no mention of you in death. In Sheol, who will praise you?" And so he's actually making an argument about why it's better to be alive than it is to be dead. In Psalm 115 and verse 17, he says, "The dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any who go down in silence." So we go from a general broad sweeping brush of they don't really talk about it to when they do start talking about it, there's not very positive things to be said about the afterlife. But as the nation continues to grow and as their relationship with God continues to evolve, what we're going to find in the Old Testament is a beginning of a hope for a happy life after death. And this is going to come up in several different passages throughout the Old Testament. And we don't have time to go through all of them this morning. But what you'll find as you see all of these different passages is that even though they are hoping for a happy life that is to come, it's still preferable to be alive. It's much better to them to be alive than it is to be dead. But then as we get closer and closer to Jesus, as we get into the exile and out of the exile, within a few hundred years of Jesus, what we're going to start seeing is instead a hope for a bodily resurrection. Now, we're going to deal with some passages today that talk about this specifically. But there are three exceptions that we want to at least briefly mention first. Throughout Israelite history, you've got three specific points, three specific men who aren't considered to be in a bad place after death. They're not considered to be anything negative about them after they die. But they're also not considered to be in this group of people with the bodily resurrection later on. So we remember we've got Enoch in the book of Genesis who was not. That's all we have about him. We don't know what happened to him. We don't really even know what that means. It just says he walked with God and he was not. All right. That's all we've got about him. We don't really know what that means. That was considered to be by most people and still is considered that Enoch was just kind of taken up to be with God. And that's it. Never experienced death. Elijah, of course, is the same way. We remember reading that story about him and how the chariots of fire came down to separate him from Elisha. And then he's taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. Well, we don't know what happens to him after that. We don't really know anything more, but we do know that he doesn't experience death, and we do know that he will not experience this same idea of bodily resurrection that's going to be prophesied. There's also the third possibility of Moses. When we deal with Moses, we never actually have like a real death scene of Moses. And so over time, the Israelites developed the idea that the same thing had happened to Moses as had happened to Enoch and Elijah. That when he got to see the promised land, he looked at it from the mountain, that from there, God just took him along. Of course, that's not biblically supported, but that was the idea that eventually came along in Jewish thought. So we do have those three that we kind of have to put to the side and think about in a different globe. But when we deal with general broad sweeping brush, we're going to get to the end of the time period of the exile and moving forward, and we're going to start seeing this hope for a bodily resurrection. So let's deal with the general resurrection in the Old Testament. What is the Old Testament going to tell us? We're going to split this up into two different ways, kind of like we've done before. We've got some possible references, and then we've got some definite references. When we read the book of Job, of course, we know the story of Job. Job has got so much stuff. He's the greatest man in the East. He has children and cows and sheep, and he's got land and servants and all of the things that he could possibly want. That, of course, are taken away from him as a test of his faith in God. And then for 40 chapters, we're going to have dialogue. And it's absolutely fascinating to go through and read all of this dialogue. You get a lot of interesting things. And let me just put this as a quick aside. If you haven't studied the book of Job, but you've only ever heard about how wrong Job's friends are, that is true. But one thing I would like to point to you, and this is a free nugget, you didn't even pay for this one today. When you look at some of the things Job's friends say about God, they at least seem to have most of God's character right, and maybe have a better understanding of God's character than we might today. That's a sermon for another time if you're ever interested in going through some of that, though, and looking at what Job's friends say about God. I think that's absolutely fascinating. But when we get into Job chapter 19, we're going to have just before this, Bildad is going to come in and he's going to be insulting Job and he's going to be saying, you know, you have obviously done some serious wrong and that's why God has caused this to come upon you. And so we get down to Job 19, and Job is going to respond to all of this. And he's going to say, you know, a lot of things are going against me right now. A lot of things that I can't explain are happening. But look down at verse 25. He says, "Yet as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh will I see God, whom I on my part shall behold for myself, and whom my eyes will see, and not another." That verse is kind of wedged in the middle there. First of all, that opening, "I know that my Redeemer lives," kind of seems like it would make a really good song, Bob. I don't know if you want to write one. You know, it seems like it might be a good idea. When we get to that middle verse, though, "Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I will see God." I don't know what your translation of the Bible says right here, but a lot of them translate this very differently. And that's because in Hebrew, that preposition can mean a lot of different things. The preposition that you're seeing as "from" in the text that I'm reading from also is translated in some places as "in my flesh" or "apart from my flesh" or some kind of different version of that. And so if we were to read this preposition like this, if we were to read this as a preposition "in," if Job was saying, "In my flesh I will see God," then that would imply that he is going to see God either in this lifetime or in a future general resurrection. If we're to translate it the way that it's translated in the version I just read, "from my flesh," that "apart from my flesh" instead would mean that he's meaning God in some kind of disembodied state, possibly in the idea of Sheol if this comes along a little bit later. But if we take a look at just Hebrew grammar, and I know none of you want to look at Hebrew grammar, I don't even want to look at Hebrew grammar, it's not a lot of fun. But when we get to that particular preposition, as we look at it, the best possible translation is not "from" as the translation that I just read, but instead "in" is the better translation because that preposition almost always refers to the future location. And so Job is saying, "In my flesh, I will see God." Now that's interesting because he could be thinking about, is God going to come down and talk to me like he does in the last two chapters of the book? Or is he saying in this context, even after my skin is destroyed, I know that my Redeemer lives, he will take his last stand on earth, and when that happens, my flesh will come to see him in a resurrection. It's a possible reference. But it's, of course, debated. There's a lot of people on both sides of that. You can decide what you think about that if you want to study a little bit of Hebrew. Of course, we also get into Ezekiel chapter 37. We remember in Ezekiel 37 how God picks up Ezekiel and he takes him out to the Valley of Dry Bones. And Ezekiel's going to ask God, "God, will these bones live?" And God's going to say, "Watch this." And all of them pick up and they rise up and they're raised. So we get this excellent vision, and of course Ezekiel wants to know what it means. And in the immediate context, God is going to tell him that this is about the national restoration of Israel. So immediately looking at the application of what happens, God is saying, okay, Israel's going to come back. There's going to be some salvation for them. But as we go a little bit further into the interpretation of this, what we're going to find is that later on, after the time of Jesus, people were going to look back at this passage in Ezekiel 37, and they're going to see a different fulfillment. They're going to see a different application of this. Now remember, we talked about prophecies that can do this when we talked about prophecies of Jesus. We talked about how there were some prophecies that have an immediate application and then they have a further application. So some of the early patristic writers within just 100 or 200 years after Jesus started talking about Ezekiel chapter 37 and they started seeing it as a prophecy of future resurrection as well. We're even going to find some paintings in a synagogue in the second century that depict Ezekiel 37 as part of the end of time. Additionally, when we get a little bit further on and we read in Matthew chapter 27, we get the death of Jesus. And right after the death of Jesus, we're going to have the tombs being opened. Many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered into the holy city and appeared to many. Could be a reference back to a specific verse in Ezekiel 37, Ezekiel 37 and verse 13. There are a lot of linguistic ties between there that could be pointing towards a future resurrection. So these are just possible passages that tell us about a something that's coming. It could be about a bodily resurrection in Job. And while Ezekiel, God does say this is about the national restoration, later authors, as they look back and understand the future better because of Jesus' resurrection, saw more behind that than maybe the initial application. So, as we get to the specific passages, there are probably 26. In Isaiah chapter 26, what we're going to find is a passage that is stuck within what we're going to call the apocalyptic section of Isaiah. And so as we start maybe back in chapter 13 somewhere, in Isaiah chapter 13, we're going to see God establishing his righteousness among the nations. And that's going to take about 10 chapters for him to talk about those kind of things. So from about 13 to 23, you're going to have that section. But then you're going to pick up in chapter 24. And what you're going to find there is that God will be victorious over the remaining cosmic powers. So you've got 10 chapters of God being all powerful and controlling all of the nations. And then you're going to have 3 chapters of God controlling everything, all of the possible cosmic powers. But included within that section, you're also going to have God being powerful and victorious over death. And so within the specific context immediate of Isaiah chapter 26, we're going to find a vivid prayer of loyalty to God in the midst of fierce persecution by pagans. So let's pick up in Isaiah chapter 26. He's going to say, "Lord, they sought you in distress. They could only whisper a prayer. Your disciple was upon them. As the pregnant woman approaches the time to give birth, she rises and cries out in her labor pains. This is how we were before you, Lord. We were pregnant, we writhed in labor, we gave birth as it seems only to wind. We could not accomplish deliverance for the earth, nor were the inhabitants of the world born. Your dead will live. Their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy, for your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. Come, my people, enter your rooms and close your doors behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. For behold, the Lord is about to come out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their wrongdoing. And the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain." That verse specifically there in verse 19. The corpses will rise. The people who have died will come back, not because of any power of mankind, but instead because of the power of God. When we read this entire section starting back in chapter 24, what we're going to find is that a lot of these passages are actually quoted in the New Testament with reference to a general resurrection. For instance, just right off the bat, Isaiah 25, 6 and 8. "Now the Lord of armies will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow, and refined with aged wine. On this mountain he will destroy the coverings of all the peoples, the veil which is stretched over all the nations. He will swallow up death for all time. The Lord will wipe away tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken." You see two right there specifically. You're going to see that connection to 1 Corinthians 15, talking about swallowing up death in victory. You're going to see that connection to Revelation 21, where it talks about God wiping away all of the tears. So all of this passage is pointing toward something more. All of this is pointing towards a general resurrection. So that's when we're going to get into Daniel chapter 12. When we get into Daniel chapter 12, what we're going to find is that there's almost no contention on this particular passage. There's almost no debate on this, that this is clearly referring to a concrete bodily resurrection. This is also probably the latest Old Testament passage to deal with this idea. The latest Old Testament passage to deal with the afterlife in any kind of specific way. And the reason is because Daniel is looking forward into a time where he's seeing the coming of Jesus. He's seeing the future, and he's as close to it as anybody's going to be who deals with this particular topic. So, as we get into Daniel chapter 12, in verse 2, he's going to say, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the everlasting contempt. And those who have insight will shine like the glow of the expanse of the heavens, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, go your way to the end. This is verse 13. Then you will rest and rise for your allotted portion at the end of the age. What this passage is doing, he's not attempting to talk about the global theory of the ultimate destination of all of the human race, but instead he's trying to affirm that there will be a renewed bodily life that God will give. And when he does that, he's going to give everlasting life to some and everlasting punishment to others. Now, the immediate context of this passage, if we're going to go back and look at what's happening in Daniel chapter 11, he's talking about the martyrdom that's going to come, and he's going to talk about the persecution that's going to come under Antiochus Epiphanes in just a couple of hundred years following that. And you can find about all of those things, by the way, in the intertestamental literature in the books of the Maccabees. You're going to get the history of the Jews that happens between the ending of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. So those are some good things to go back and study and read. But in Daniel chapter 11, you're going to get a prophecy of Antiochus's abomination of desolation and some of the things that are going to happen with that. And right after he prophesies that, he's going to talk about how some of the Jewish people are going to make compromises with the nation that is oppressing them. But then as he wraps up at the end of chapter 11, he's going to talk about how Antiochus is going to boast. He's going to think full. He's going to be full of himself. And then because of that, he is eventually going to fall. And then when we get into Daniel chapter 12, in that context, we are going to see that he is prophesying some future hope. Yes, there's a lot of bad things coming. Yes, there's a lot of persecution coming, but there is something better that will happen. So, what we find specifically in these verses is because it's later on in the evolution of Israel, because it's later on in the progression of what's happening with their relationship with God, we're going to find a more defined version of resurrection. And we're going to find that everybody's going to be raised. Some people are going to be raised to everlasting reward. Some people to everlasting punishment. But look at what happens in the middle of that back in verse 2. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. What that means is that he's prophesying when the resurrection comes, when the general resurrection happens, it's not going to happen to you immediately. It's not going to be something that happens to you as soon as you die. It is something that there's something in the middle. After death, there is some kind of intermediate state that happens, and then we will all be raised, good and bad, at the same time. So we have an intermediate period that he discusses, but then also we have a bodily resurrection. And so that's the last real Old Testament passage as far as timeline of Old Testament that deals with the general resurrection. But he's pointing us toward what Jesus is going to talk about in his own teaching. So let's pick up in Matthew chapter 12. The general resurrection is referred to many times throughout Jesus' teachings. I picked out just a few today that I think are extremely relevant and will help us to see what the Bible is pointing toward. So in Matthew chapter 12, starting in verse 38, some of the scribes and Pharisees said to Jesus, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." He answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves a sign. No sign will be given except the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was in the stomach of the sea monster for 3 days and three nights, so will the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. Then the men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment, and they will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. Then the queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment, and she will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Look at this immediate context. We've talked about this passage a little bit already, but in this passage, Jesus is talking about his own personal resurrection first. He says that just like Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days, so also will Jesus be in the earth for 3 days. But eventually, he is going to rise. And when he rises, that's going to be proof that there will be a general resurrection. And he says, now here's how you're going to know that, is because these people who Jonah preached to in Nineveh, who have been dead for a very, very long time, they're going to stand next to you who are alive right now. You're going to get to meet them. You're going to get to see them. The Queen of the South you've read about in the Old Testament talking to Solomon, you're going to get to meet her. And they're going to condemn you because you were in the presence of the resurrection. And we'll talk about what that means in just a minute. What he says here is people who are dead are going to rise again. And they will stand with the people who are alive. Let's look at Mark chapter 12. And we won't read this whole passage because it's a lengthy passage, but I think a lot of us know it. But we've got in verse 18 the Sadducees who say that there is no resurrection in Mark chapter 12 and verse 18. So that's their initial point right off the bat. Mark wants us to know that the people who are coming to Jesus say that there is no resurrection. So they come to Jesus and they say, look, Moses told us that, you know, if someone dies and his brother is left behind and he leaves a wife and then all of these other brothers die and she's got to marry all seven of them. Well, if there's a resurrection, Jesus, who's she going to be married to? And so we pick up in verse 24. Jesus says to them, is this not the reason you are mistaken? You don't understand the scriptures nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, Jesus comes back with a very strong statement. The Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection of the dead, but they're going to throw out this question at Jesus to try and trick him, to try and trap him. And Jesus, instead of playing their games or doing anything like that, he comes back with this strong statement. This is not an if statement. It is not if they rise from the dead. This is when they rise from the dead. But think about this when we step back and look at the Sadducees coming to Jesus, not believing in the resurrection. Why would they come to him with this question? Unless he has been teaching it throughout his entire ministry. And that's exactly what we're going to find throughout the New Testament, throughout the gospel accounts. Jesus says, when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Regarding the fact that the dead rise, have you not read in the book of Moses in the passage about the burning bush? God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are greatly mistaken. Let's look very quickly at John chapter 5. When we pick up in John chapter 5, starting in verse 24, Jesus says, truly I say to you, the one who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life. He does not come into judgment, but has passed out of death into life. Truly I say to you, a time is coming, and even now has arrived, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For just as the Father has life in himself, so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself, and he gave him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Now pause there for just a minute. Jesus says, a time is coming, and is right now. So these first couple of verses that he's talking about are things that are happening in their presence. They're in a metaphorical sense. The dead are hearing the voice of God. But then he picks up in verse 28. Instead of saying, this is happening now, he says again, a time is coming and will come when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice. And they will come out, those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, and those who committed the bad deeds to a resurrection of judgment. Jesus, talking about the future here, basically says, what's happening in my life is a precursor of the things to come. What you're seeing here, what you will see here with what I'm going to be doing, is only a taste of the good things that will happen. There's a lot more surprises along the way, Jesus says, so I want you to be ready for them. Now, of course, we could spend a lot of time digging into each and every other reference that Jesus makes to the general resurrection. But of course, there's probably no greater reference to it than in John chapter 11. We remember what happens in John chapter 11, how Jesus hears that his friend has become very sick. And instead of immediately going to go and heal Lazarus of his illness, Jesus waits for just a little bit. And he waits, and what ends up happening is Lazarus dies. And so he gets on the scene after the death of Lazarus. And so let's pick up in about verse 23 of John chapter 11 here. Martha comes to Jesus and she says in verse 21, "Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Almost kind of like insulting Jesus just a little bit. Almost kind of saying, "Jesus, if you had been here, but you weren't, my brother would not have died, but he did. This is your fault, Jesus." But then she says, "Even now I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus says in verse 23, "Your brother will rise again." Now listen to Martha's response here. She says, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." This exchange right here shows us that Jesus' teachings to his disciples were well known. This is something that they talked about a lot. Because when he initially comes back saying, "Your brother's going to rise again," Jesus is thinking, "Okay, I'm about to raise this guy from the dead." She doesn't know that. She's thinking, "Okay, this stuff that Jesus has been talking about this whole time is what he's teaching me here again." So Martha says, "I know there's a resurrection that's coming on the last day because you've taught it, Jesus, and I know he will rise again." Listen to what Jesus says. "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even if he dies. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." Jesus says, present tense, "I am the resurrection." And so, if we follow the logic of Paul, if Jesus is still in the tomb, then the resurrection is gone. But Jesus was raised, which means that he is what? Still, present tense, right now in 2021, the resurrection. That means that he still has the power to do what he's going to do to Lazarus here in just a minute. When we get to the remainder of the story, of course, we're going to see Jesus going and raising Lazarus from the dead as proof of his power, as proof of his ability to raise people from the dead. And so we get this sign of a coming resurrection. Once again, all throughout Jesus' teachings, we've got the point of the general resurrection. After Jesus, remember we talked about how beginning in the Old Testament, the first relationships that happened with God don't really, he doesn't really need to focus on the afterlife. They need to focus on the present, the here and now, and their relationship with God. But that's going to evolve and that's going to progress. And so after we have the resurrection of Jesus, after we've got this establishment of the church, the general resurrection is now preached in full all throughout the entire New Testament. Acts 24 and verse 15, Romans 6 and verse 5, 1 Corinthians 15, 2 Corinthians 5, Philippians 3, 20 and 21, 1 Thessalonians 4, 13 through 8. All of a sudden, we've got an entire testament chock full of discussion of general resurrection. These are just some of the passages. You think God has a point? You think he's trying to tell us something? You think there's a reason behind all of these things? When we look at the general resurrection, we talked about last week, if we believe that Jesus rose from the dead, then we have to believe in the future resurrection. Because Jesus is proof, but also because the Bible talks about it over and over again. The Old Testament talks about it. Jesus talks about it. The New Testament authors all talk about it. The entire Bible teaches there will be a general resurrection. So, what does it tell us about that? What details does the Bible give us about what the future resurrection will be like, what it will look like, and what will happen? We'll deal with that next week. Thank you for your attention. I'll see you then.